Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawain. This hour, we're going to be looking at the unprecedented challenges the coronavirus pandemic is presenting to people living with addiction. For many trying to maintain sobriety, group meetings held online have been a godsend. But for others, social distancing has sidelined the sense of camaraderie and support offered by connecting with peers in person. Also, as time at home wears on, navigating family and work often presents significant stressors, prompting some to break sobriety. We'll be joined by two experts a little later this hour, and phone lines will be open. But we begin with an update on Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. Kensington, of course, challenged by the opioid and homeless crises. However, according to Billy Penn, as of late last week, there were 309 cases of COVID-19 in the Kensington zip code, and 28% of residents tested have been found to be positive. Jose Benitez is executive director of Prevention Point, whose mission is to promote health, empowerment, and safety for communities affected by drug use and poverty. And Jose, as always, it's so good to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate the invitation.
As we've reported numerous times on this show, Jose, the opioid epidemic has simply devastated Kensington's residents and its large homeless population. And now, of course, there's the pandemic. So how are people, especially those grappling with addiction, coping? What are you seeing?
So, as you said, it's a neighborhood that is very, very stressed on, with normal conditions. And what we're seeing now is more and more of those effects, taking a hold in Kensington. I think what we're really seeing on the street at this particular point is people who are now struggling for just basic needs like food. We always had the challenge of people seeking out shelter. It's sort of tenfold at this particular point. We're still seeing folks, needing those services, and those services becoming more and more limited in terms of what our service providers can provide to them at this particular point.
So is there anybody stepping in to fill the gap? What does that picture look like?
Yeah, so I think, the city has done a really, really good job of coordinating some services from different kinds of providers to come in. So I know that, COVID testing is something that we hope to have coming online in the next week or so. There is, the Step Up to the Plate program, which is a meals program that was organized by Broad Street Ministries, Project Home, and Prevention Point, to begin to feed people in the community. So we have about a little over 600 meals going out every day to families and community members of and the homeless in Kensington. There are a little more coordinated activities with the federally qualified health centers. So Esperanza Center providing some medical services, and as well as like agencies like Philadelphia Fight, who are coming out to assist in setting up a COVID testing site. So all of that, I know the city's thinking about putting up a drop-in center as well, so that we can get folks indoors, give folks a chance to wash their hands and access showers. So all of those are, new additional services coming online in the Kensington area to serve the people that are both homeless and the community folks there.
It's got to be extraordinarily difficult, Jose, to enforce social distancing measures among a transient population. What are folks that you encounter on the street telling you?
So I think, for example, we had to take some measures around social distancing. So for example, in this, Step Up to the Plate program, where we're feeding folks and You know, we're seeing about 600 people in a couple of hours. Mm. You know, Mural Arts was really helpful in actually drawing, you know, sort of pads and signs on the ground so that people knew where to stand. So there's some visual cues when we're doing sort of organized, you know, service delivery. And that's true throughout Kensington. I mean, you know, the same thing happens at our soup kitchens in Kensington. And so people are really trying to figure out how to make sure that people maintain social distancing. I think it becomes more of an issue when, you know, people sort of are hanging on the street or walking up and down the avenue. I think that's been, you know, a struggle for everybody on how to figure out. And I think the way to for us to do that or think about it as service providers is to try to get as much mask and, yes, and gloves, you know, protective personal protective equipment out to people in those communities.
That was the next question. Is there a sufficient number of masks, different disinfectants being made readily available to those who are without shelter? So at this point, it sounds like not yet, but you're trying to get there.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, right, you know, we've had to take, and I think every service provider is probably going through the same, you know, through in the same situation, right? We needed to make some decisions based on, you know, making sure that the staff who's delivering the service, we have enough protective equipment for staff at this particular
sure.
point. The issue was, and for the last, you know, several weeks, as we all have become aware in the national news, that, you know, it's sort of like a supply issue at this particular point. We are now starting to see some of that loosen up. And so for us, we are to the point where we're now giving out protective equipment to some of the homeless folks or anyone actually in the community that comes up to us to ask. I mean, you know, those are going to be, you know, it's hit or miss, honestly, because the supply chain is just really difficult, and it hasn't been easy for us to obtain enough protective equipment at this point to give out to everyone.
And yet, at the same time,
Jose. When we have extra, you know, we'll certainly distribute it.
And you're also dealing with the opioid crisis as well. I read the prevention point is continuing to hand out naloxone, but the kits with a nod to the pandemic have some added safety features.
Yeah. So look, you know, with all of this, right, the usual challenges that face us in the community are the same. You know, we still have overdoses happening. You know, so we sort of made a conscious effort to really, get out naloxone. And, you know, just to give you a sense of what we've done, since March 13th, we have distributed over 2,000 doses. And we were at, you know, we weren't near that until recently.
Has the pandemic made it a lot more difficult for you to do your job in trying to ease the opioid crisis in Kensington?
It has. And I'll tell you how, right? You know, we have confined spaces. So if you look at it, like one of the first things that we had to do was to, you know, close our drop-in center, which is an engagement center. People can come in, have a cup of coffee, sometimes take a shower, depending on the time of day, grab a sandwich, and access social services or clinical services, you know, medical services. We needed to close that. That was one of the first programs that sort of closed because we see about 250 people a day at Prevention Point. It's a really tight space. And so we did not want to become the source of, you know, the COVID infection
sure.
during this crisis. So those programs all moved to sort of curbside, right? So So we have like grab and go sandwiches and, you know, our medically assisted treatment clients that are in our clinic are coming in to check with us once a month. If they, you know, we can do that curbside or by telephone. So we've had to really become creative in how we deliver the services that we normally do. But what that does is it does limit the contact that we have with people. And, you know, it's a little bit different to have someone in a room and really get people's personal stories and make a personal human-to-human connection.
So we're hearing, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really difficult to do that sort of on the street with a few minutes when there's a lot of people sort of on the queue waiting to get seen for something.
What sort of impact, Jose, has this had on people who are on the street, who are dealing with perhaps an opioid addiction and also trying to deal with the COVID crisis? What sort of impact has this had on them as they try to move forward with their lives? They don't have the camaraderie, as we said earlier in the opening, of group meetings and being able to talk face to face with people and get some close personal contact.
Right. And I think a lot of these programs that are offering, like us, we're offering, you know, sort of like from our medically assisted treatment program, we're doing as much, telephone and FaceTime kind of medicine, right? And it's something that we sort of decided that we needed to do. But there are a lot of folks that don't have telephones and that are struggling with sort of the human connection, making that, finding the support that they're going to need. So it even becomes more difficult for people to sort of have the natural supports that are in these networks. And, you know, when you're homeless, there's also sort of a support. And so what we're hearing, especially out of the meals program, when we're providing meals to people, what we consistently hear from people is how lonely people feel in this. And so, you know, that's something that as service providers, we have noticed and is a recurring theme for people.
So, Jose, we only have a few seconds left in this segment, but if this continues, the pandemic continues for weeks or even months, I know you said the city's doing a good job, but what more needs to happen to help this particular population?
So I think a couple of things, right? Like, I think all of us as service providers are really struggling through how our programs need to look different. So I think having those kinds of ongoing conversations in a network of providers is important for us to have. Second, we need more protective personal equipment on the street. I think, you know,
we've only got about 5 seconds, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right.
So those are the two.
All right. Jose Benitez, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Mary. I appreciate you guys having me.
Jose is Executive Director of Prevention Point. And up next, we'll take your calls. We'll have two experts on addiction coming up on Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Marty's got the day off today. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Recovery from substance or alcohol abuse is lived one day at a time, according to experts. So what happens when your days have been upended by the coronavirus? Group meetings have moved online, face-to-face counseling as well. Treatment centers are shut down or reluctant to take new patients. There are long stretches spent on lockdown with few distractions and other stressors which could threaten sobriety, concerns about work or lack of it. Perhaps it's tougher to access medicines which prevent opioid withdrawal and allow users to rebuild their lives. The challenges faced by many in recovery during the pandemic Ease a Crisis Within a Crisis. For the rest of the hour, we will speak with two experts for insight and direction, and the phones will be open. 888-477-9499 is the number to call with questions or comments. You can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Robert Ashford is director of the nonprofit Unity Recovery, and he is co-founder and executive director of Unity Recovery, which is a recovery community organization and center located in Philadelphia. Welcome, Robert. We have Robert Ashford with us. Okay, let's see if we have our other guest. Marina Goldman is an addiction psychiatrist in private practice, and she has also served as the president of the Philadelphia Psychiatric Society and co-chairs their annual Addictions Symposium. Marina, you there? Hello, I can hear something. I'm hearing you, Marina.
This is Robert.
Oh, we've got Robert. Okay, so let's we'll try to reconnect with Marina because I can barely hear her. But Robert, we've got you, so we'll get started with you. Welcome to Radio Times. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me and for doing the segment that's so critically important for the community.
All right. Well, so the pandemic has obviously caused a seismic shift in the way people in recovery or are seeking recovery access services. What did Unity Recovery offer before the pandemic, Robert, and what had to change with the onset of social distancing?
Absolutely. So prior to the middle of March, you know, as a recovery community organization and center, we offered the community peer-based recovery support services, which looked like a couple of different things. All of them were free and were subsidized by grants from the state and the federal government and local foundations like IBX. But we provided one-on-one peer services, which follows the social determinants framework, mutual aid meetings, which listeners may more commonly known as AA or NA, Smart Recovery, Refuge Recovery, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And also a suite of pro-social activities, which are substance-free bowling nights, movie nights, and activities. And then also recovery yoga at our location in Manayunk, which is very easy to do yoga, gentle flow that's focused on recovery from behavioral health disorders. And we offered that for every day of the week, 7 days a week, open almost 12 hours a day. But when the pandemic hit,
yes,
we transitioned and phased into virtual services, which started with closing down the meetings. And then as we got towards March 19th, closing down the center completely and moving everything online, which has allowed quite a bit to happen. So we've been able to emulate every single service we provided before. So one-on-one services, mutual aid meetings, recovery yoga. But we've also been to work with a national partnership of other RCOs like Alano Club of Portland and SOS Recovery in New Hampshire and We Connect Health in Seattle to actually expand the reach. So today, every day, we offer 9 all-recovery meetings on a virtual platform, weekly recovery yoga and CrossFit and guided meditations, a 24/7 recovery chat, all still for free. And we're serving almost 70,000 people in over 20 countries in the last 7 weeks.
70,000 people. Oh, okay. I want to get into moving from in-person to online, but let's bring Dr. Marina Goldman into the conversation. She's been in clinical practice in psychiatry and addiction psychiatry. She's also served again as the president of the Philadelphia Psychiatric Society. Welcome to the show, Marina.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, let's get to the online version of therapy and group meetings. But Marina, these group meetings, whether you're physically there or online, are critical to the recovery process. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so for many patients in recovery, they find the meetings very helpful. It provides what your previous guests have mentioned. It provides very important peer support, peer feedback. People who are struggling in recovery are dealing with addiction, and the most prominent experience in terms of facing relapse or finding abstinence is dealing with cravings. And the cravings can come at any point. A person is vulnerable to them 24/7. And the peer support is one of the essential ways that people can manage those cravings. In addition to the medications that we prescribe, the peer support really becomes a very important support as well.
Robert Ashford, what works and what does not work with group meetings online?
So it's important to consider the differences, but also the striking similarities. So putting these online, it's just telephonic, which has existed long before the pandemic. It doesn't necessarily emulate with great efficacy the ability to see nonverbal communication, empathy on people's faces. So what's working well now, as technology has advanced and video is quite common, especially low bandwidth video that's available on many platforms, is people can still see all of those nonverbal cues, the empathy, compassion, direct communication and eye contact. The other benefits that didn't necessarily exist for in-person but do online and that we're seeing, especially in meetings that can be 300-plus from all around the United States, all around the world, is the frame of reference, the type of social support and networking that's possible when you have that many people, especially in a time of crisis, can really work to enhance that fellowship aspect or the social connection aspect that was talked about previously. That does make these so well. It just enhances that effect, that it compounds. Because when you're connected to 20 people face-to-face in a recovery support group meeting of any type, that's one thing. But when you're connected to 300, especially when we're dealing with feelings of isolation that may trigger cravings and other important considerations for recovery, it really has a positive effect. Plus, it reduces all the barriers that somebody might have to going to in-person meetings previously. Transportation is no longer an issue. The ability to find childcare is no longer an issue, or work schedules, especially if you're working from home. It does have unintended barriers. You know, we still live in a country where high-speed internet access is not ubiquitous.
Yes.
It's still a commodity, not a utility, certainly. But overall, the positive effects we've seen, both from emulating the in-person experience and then having unintended benefits, like just scope and size of the social network, I think are all really important points.
Marina, what is your take on online versus in-person and how people can adjust?
So I agree with Robert. It's it was really quite miraculous to see, really, even in the very beginnings of March, when we were all concerned about the spread of COVID-19, people very spontaneously started to convert, especially their 12-step AA meetings, to Zoom meetings. They just sort of knew that that's what needed to happen, and they just made it happen. And then since then, all the different agencies that have also implemented virtual access to care. So that's really been just wonderful. What I think I agree with Robert in all of the points he's made, but there is there's something still missing for some patients. So people are still finding that not being physically in the room with others is hard. So I think of it like an 80% success. So I think all of these virtual services are providing at least 80% of what people need. And that's really great, because without them, we would be in a lot of trouble. But
sure.
There's something still missing, and it can be frustrating for some patients to feel like they can't quite get that extra 20% that they're getting from really being in the same space with another, being seen in that very particular way.
So what are some of your thoughts for these folks who might need a little bit more? You know, this is what they have right now online. It's a great alternative. It might not be perfect for some people, but if they need that, if they're craving the physical comfort of having somebody sitting next to them in a chair, what can they do?
Well, again, people have gotten quite creative. They will sometimes have backyard meetings. You know, they'll get together with just a couple of people in the backyard, and social, you know, all the physical distancing guidelines they put in place, but it feels to them a little bit more comfortable that way. Not everybody has access to that. People can also spend more time one-on-one. This is where sponsors in the 12-step AA model become important, that there could be more time spent one-on-one in that way. Again, it's on the phone or it's virtual, but it provides a little bit more support in that regard. But I think we've all of my colleagues have been encouraging our patients to really take advantage of the virtual services because they're still quite important. And the fact that they're available and available in such a ubiquitous way as Robert has been describing, I think is really, really wonderful.
We've got calls and comments coming in to 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Amy has sent this comment. I'm 13 months sober and attend daily Zoom AA meetings. I've been good, but the thing that has struck me is how much talk there is of alcohol on social media platforms. People concerned about state store hours, virtual happy hours, casual jokes about day drinking, and assumptions about how we're all handling stress with wine, etc. I can handle seeing the concern about access to alcohol, but the joking and assumptions about drinking behavior is hard for me. Marina, what's your take on this?
I agree. Let me expand a little bit. Yeah, it's definitely a concern. So we underestimate culturally the addictive potential of alcohol. Alcohol addiction and the medical consequences of alcohol addiction is still a very significant burden on our healthcare system and causes a tremendous suffering among our patients and loss of life. It is still an epidemic. And when we highlight the joy of alcohol use without really balancing against the possible harms, then it can lead to people overusing, and especially in women, there's a telescopic effect. Women tend to be much more sensitive to becoming addicted to alcohol quicker and suffering the medical consequences, all the toxic effects from alcohol, the liver, the brain, the heart, damage that results from alcohol use. And none of that is advertised in the alcohol ads, right? So on cigarette boxes, we now have all these warnings, this could kill you. And when we're advertising culturally alcohol, we're not reminding our friends that we're using something dangerous.
So in this age of social distancing, in which many of us are finding comfort in social media platforms, maybe for somebody on Amy's journey, somehow you step back a little, because it sounds as if it's a little overwhelming for her, you know, with her friends all talking about, you know, resorting to a glass of wine at the end of the day. Yeah. That might not be healthy for her.
Well, it's not healthy for her, and I don't think it's healthy in general. So this is where we've been working very closely with our primary care docs and all the sort of frontline people in healthcare to continue to educate patients that alcohol should be used very sparingly. When it becomes a daily drink at the end of the day to manage stress, that could become toxic and dangerous. So Amy's point is right on, and I think it's important that we remember there are other coping strategies with stress. Mm-hmm. Alcohol is not the best coping strategy because it has potential toxic and dangerous effects.
Amy, thank you so much for reaching out to us, and the best to you on your journey. Robert Ashford, you are 8 years now in your recovery journey. Tell us a bit about your story, and on a personal level, you know, how you are dealing with changes brought about the pandemic. You expounded a bit at the beginning of the segment about how your business, your Unity Recovery has shifted. How about on a personal level for you?
Absolutely. And thanks for the question. I quickly will add for the previous comment is, especially on social media, that the recommendation should really be for Amy to curate what her social media content looks like in terms of not allowing ads that are from alcohol distributors or brands, but also to curate her personal feed list and network so that she is seeing much more recovery-oriented content. It should be an activity that everybody, especially in early recovery, that first year, should take on all of their social media platforms to limit that kind of interaction. And I hope she gets the chance to do so. For my personal recovery, and I'm very out and open as a person in recovery from both substance use disorders and mental health disorders, I get to do a lot of things to support that, and even pre-pandemic, but certainly now, as times have gotten quite hectic for many of us, including those not in recovery, So what that looks like on a daily basis is making sure to connect both to my recovery network. So whether that is the Zoom meetings and digital all recovery meetings that I attend on a daily basis, making sure to do guided meditations or yoga nidra, but also making sure to connect with one-on-one with my other social circle that may not, whether they're in recovery or not, but making sure to reach out to friends and checking in on them to maintain the humanistic elements. My recovery outside of the daily recovery support services that I utilize requires connection. And though that is very digital at the moment, that connection for me is still quite rewarding. On a day-to-day basis, especially when anxiety may creep up or being, you know, working from home for the last 6 weeks, it's reminding myself that, you know, this too shall pass, which is a common cliche in recovery circles, and making sure to do the things that I know worked even before the pandemic. They may look different, but they still work just as well.
But important to reach out. Critical to reach out.
Absolutely.
Okay. What do the first 3 months of recovery typically look like? Marina, how are they usually structured by therapists?
Well, so the first 3 months of recovery really is focused around understanding our patient's goals of recovery. Everybody will come into treatment in a different place. And we spend the first 3 months thinking with our patients, talking to them about their personal goals. Some people want to cut back. Some people want to stop altogether. Sometimes there are multiple substances. There are problems that have happened in their life that they want to address. Maybe they've become more disconnected, multiple losses that have impacted them. So the first 3 months is really helping them figure out their goals of treatment and getting them started. And it often involves what Robert has been talking about, making connections, whether it's reconnecting with family, reconnecting with sober supports. And ultimately, in that first phase, patients will typically develop a plan, a treatment plan with their provider to help them continue to make progress and then reassess how well they're doing. So not everybody.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to jump in just because we're up against a break, but we'll continue the point as soon as we're back. Marina Goldman is an addiction psychiatrist in private practice. Robert Ashford is co-founder and executive director of Unity Recovery. We're talking about the recovery journey in the age of the pandemic and coping strategies and much more. We're taking your calls as well. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty. We are talking about addiction and recovery during the coronavirus pandemic with Robert Ashford, co-founder and executive director of Unity Recovery, and Marina Goldman, an addiction psychiatrist in private practice in the Philadelphia area. We're taking your calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email along to radiotimes@whyy.org. So going into the break, Marina, we were talking about the first 3 months of recovery. Fair to say this is probably one of the most vulnerable times in a person's recovery and something to be especially aware of during the pandemic when there are so many other stressors now in place?
Yeah, the first year of recovery, it tends to be very vulnerable for patients. And the first 3 months really is where we try to put in place a treatment plan to meet their goals. For some patients, that means they're going to go right into a detox and a rehab because that's the safest place for them to start. For others, they'll continue in an outpatient setting if we feel that we can provide adequate supports. But the risk of relapse remains about the same for the first year. The most important component of treatment is basically what Robert's been saying, is to ensure that the person stays connected to treatment. As long as the patient can stay connected through whatever means is available, then they have a better prognosis of succeeding.
We've got a telephone call from Jack in Northeast Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Times, Jack.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, how are you?
I'm good. I was listening to your show, and I really found it interesting.
Thank you.
I'm sober, coming up on a year. Sunday will be a year. And what we've been doing up here is some of the established meetings have been moving outside, like into a parking lot or into a field next to the meeting house, and social distancing and having the meeting outside when weather's permitting. And I find that really good because I like the face-to-face. I do a Zoom meeting every Wednesday night, but I like the I'm a little older. I think I like the old-school meetings better where, you know, you actually meet people and see them. Although, you know, you have to practice the social distancing. We bring our own chairs and everything, you know.
So Jack, how has the coronavirus pandemic affected you? Has it affected you other than the fact that you've had to, you know, move your meetings outside and practice social distancing? Are you feeling any extra pressure, or are you, it sounds as if you're doing okay.
No, not really. You know, part of recovery is change, and we had to change, and I've had to change my routine, and not that I'm perfectly fine with it, but I'm doing the best I can. And you know, typical alcoholics that I know of, and myself included, don't do well with change, but we have to change. There's always change. Everything changes. And this is part of the change we have to deal with right now, with the hope that it'll go back to quote-unquote normal in the future.
Yeah. Jack, thank you so much for calling, and congratulations on your one-year anniversary.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
You too. Let's go to Dave now in Fairmount, Philadelphia. Dave, you're live on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I just got out of treatment a few weeks ago. I developed an opiate. Sorry, let me try to get to a quiet place. It's really loud. I developed an opiate habit and, you know, sought help and went away and came out into quarantine. And it's been a very challenging experience. You know, as anybody can say, like the base of these programs is connection and community, and kind of avoiding isolation has been a very hard thing. But, you know, at the same time, these Zoom meetings are incredibly helpful. And they've really been kind of a godsend, you know, and it's cool because you can find Zoom meetings anywhere in the world. You know, you can go international and you can find meetings in Europe, and the experience is very similar for everyone. So it's just been, you know, it's been challenging, but it also, you know, there are outlets for people out there that want to get better.
Robert Ashford, it sounds as if, you know, Dave is doing well, although, as you mentioned, there are challenges, Dave. And I see on the screen you're 73 days sober.
Yeah.
Robert, you have any thoughts for Dave?
I do. First and foremost, congratulations on 73 days. You know, we have been able to engage with a lot of people that are coming out of treatment that are in very similar circumstances as to you. They went in, especially to an inpatient facility, whether that was 30 days, 45, and came out to a completely different world. And the recommendation is to expand what recovery supports look like today, right? Meetings, whether they're AA, SMART, or All Recovery, or any others, is certainly one point. But I think connecting to, whether it's an RCO like ours here in Philly, Unity, to work one-on-one with a peer, to do other recovery support services, such as yoga, or connecting in other ways just besides meetings, because that connection, starting it now, is certainly predictive, at least empirically in the research, for longer-term success. But I think it'll open up to a range of possibilities that may expand past just one formal program of recovery. So as you said, internationally, locally, there is a ton out there right now, and everybody is doing it out of the kind of as a philanthropic gesture. So I certainly encourage you to expand what that network looks like for you now, and then continue that once the pandemic ends, and keep up the good work. You know, recovery is different. It's hard, but it's really rewarding. Keep doing what you're doing.
Does it become, I hate to use the word easier, but I can't think of anything else. Does recovery become easier as time goes by?
So recovery is different for everyone, right? And I think it's important that we, define what that means, which is really means the person in recovery gets to define what that recovery looks like for them. For some, that is abstinence. For some, that is harm reduction and moderation. For some, it means going to therapy, accessing treatment, accessing their religious institutions or spirituality, doing yoga, any number of things. But recovery is not a one-size-fits-all approach and means something different for everybody. And depending on the person, people's experiences can certainly be characterized as easy, hard, difficult, or just normal. And I think that's what gets harder or easier is the kind of commonplace routines that people put in their life. You know, something that is not commonplace or habit forming at 7 days may become habit forming and kind of ingrained 7 weeks later as that becomes more common. So that part gets easier. But I think it's the characterization of hard or easy is somewhat, I think, not helpful, because we don't want people, especially those of listeners out there that may be still actively using or having symptoms from their mental health disorder or not having a disorder and just misusing substances, that this process isn't hard. It's just different, but it is incredibly rewarding. And there is a ton of support out there, whether that's clinical or community-based, that will walk in partnership with you on that journey. But it's certainly not hard. It's just different.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that point. And Dave, we wish you well. Thank you for checking in with us here on Radio Times. Robert, very quickly before we get back to Marina, we've got a tweet from Ann who says, I'm 7 years sober, and I have such gratitude in this crazy COVID moment for Unity Recovery. What a blessing. Thanks for keeping me sober. So I just wanted to pass that
along.
We
appreciate the support.
So Marina, you know, we've talked about underlying mental health issues. You know, for many people who are living with addiction, there is a need to address mental health issues as well. Has this been more of a challenge over the past month and a half, or is telemedicine filling the gap?
Well, yeah, it has been more of a challenge, and telemedicine is really trying to fill the gap. And I think just like what we said about virtual meetings, we're doing reasonably well. So certainly anxiety has gone up for everyone because the pandemic has created a kind of background anxious state for everyone. That's a normal response to something, this level of change, this level of uncertainty. And so for many patients who are already struggling with anxiety or depression or bipolar disorder, that higher level of anxiety has felt more difficult to manage. But with telemedicine, exactly what Robert said, a lot of barriers to accessing care have actually gone down. People can access care directly from their home. They don't need to worry about getting child care or transportation. So there's in a way, greater access or availability of care, and people can be seen more frequently. Medications can be offered, hopefully sooner as well. So there has been much more stress, but, we've been looking at ways to continue to support our patients through all this.
Marina Goldman, let's get into family support, the family that might be living with a person in addiction during the pandemic. That person might be feeling stressors. The family might be feeling stressors. Mm-hmm. What is the role of the family, and might also need to seek some support?
Yes. So in all of our addiction treatment programs, we've typically involved family members at some point. We always look for opportunities to help family members to get involved because addiction can cause disruptions in family relationships, and those need to be repaired. Mental illness, whether it's depression or severe anxiety or bipolar disorder, can also cause disruptions in family relationships. So, again, we try to involve family members in the treatment course as much as possible. The stress at home can definitely amplify frustration, anxiety, and trying to involve family members more in the virtual visits. Again, in a way, the virtual telehealth visits are more, you know, lend themselves more to that because everyone's at home. So it's possible to have a family meeting. If we're sensing that that's becoming an issue, we can then schedule a family meeting and say, let's all talk together and figure out how to problem solve. So it's been harder, but there are things that have also been more accessible because of the virtual telehealth.
Don't be afraid to seek help, bottom line. Words count. Richard, you are lead author of a new study at Penn, which essentially found it's best to stop using terms like addict and alcoholic when talking about people with substance use disorders. Such words can do actual harm?
They can, and it's, you know, we've spent a lot of time, my colleagues and I at Penn, as we did this linguistics research around stigma, bias, and discrimination. And it's really a two-factor process of how that harm can come to be. So one, which is the most prevalent, you know, substance use disorders are the fourth most stigmatized disease worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. And when we look closer to home, we see those impacts in real time, right? So employment offers rescinded. We see housing denied. We see education opportunities denied. And we see criminal justice institutions in the war on drugs impact people that may be labeled junkies, addicts, alcoholics, et cetera. And by just changing that language, we can begin to see that subconscious and explicit conscious bias begin to be reduced and be more positively biased. But internally to the person in recovery, there's also impacts. So we found in that research that individuals, whether they were 12-step oriented or not in their personal path of recovery, that internalized and consciously used words like addict and alcoholic actually had lower self-esteem and senses of self-efficacy. And while the recommendation for the person in recovery should always be to have the autonomy to decide how to self-label, especially in mutual aid meetings, as is common with tradition, the recommendation for anybody else, a person not in recovery, a family member, a policymaker, first responder, anybody, journalist, et cetera, should never be using stigmatizing language. So substance abuse, addict, alcoholic, relapse should all be gone and replaced by words like person with a substance use disorder, person in recovery, recurrence of use or recurrence of symptoms, using pharmacotherapy instead of medication-assisted treatment, because it's one of the easiest ways to make a positive impact today, which doesn't require systems transformation or heavy reinvestment with fiscal resources. So it's ways that we can do things for free and make a positive impact to the most stigmatized disease that we, one of the most stigmatized that we know of. We should take that opportunity today and every day.
Facebook message from Carolyn. I work at a community behavioral health nonprofit in New Jersey. Right now, everyone is a peer in the sense of going through COVID-19. So a lot more community members are seeking out our support. If this pandemic occurred even 10 years ago, I think the ease of online video connecting and the stigma of mental health would have kept many people from accessing help. Marina, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I think... Well, definitely the stigma. So everything that Robert just said about how we're changing our dialogue, our language, and people's acceptance and understanding that symptoms of depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, symptoms that have to do with substance use disorders, that they are part of an illness, just like any other type of illness that a person may encounter in their life. I think there has been a lot less stigma in the last 10 years, and certainly our ability to communicate with each other virtually has improved. So we probably have benefited in the current moment from all of those changes. And I think we've taken very good advantage of them in helping others.
So stigma and being perceived in an unflattering way, as we were talking about earlier, as far as words are concerned, that could actually prevent some people from getting help.
It has. It has prevented people from getting help for decades. People were afraid to see a psychiatrist. People were afraid to go to a 12-step meeting because they did not want to be labeled and stigmatized. But we're seeing that change, and there's still stigma, of course, but there's been a very positive shift and a cultural shift that's been more accepting and understanding, and that's, I think, made it a lot easier for people to seek help.
Sorry, Robert, we've got about 10 seconds left. If you are on the recovery journey and you're feeling stressed in the pandemic, there is help.
Absolutely. And I want to take the last time we have to thank all of the peers and the community members at Unity and all of our partners across the country for making digital recovery support services available. If you're out there struggling, the help is there. Check out unityrecovery.org and get connected to the recovery supports you need today. But
okay.
Thanks, everybody. And
Robert is director of Unity Recovery. Sorry for jumping in there. Marina Goldman, good to have you with us as well. Marina is an addiction psychiatrist in private practice. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Be well.